Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. During National Cancer Survivor Month in June, Dr. Lindsay Morton of the National Cancer Institute and the Lymphoma Research Foundation spoke about her research on the long-term risks of developing second cancers among cancer survivors. She discussed treatment exposure, genetics, and lifestyle elements such as smoking as factors that may pose a risk for developing a second cancer. She also detailed findings from her studies on second cancer risk factors across several disease types and treatment options, including one on risks associated with immunosuppression for solid organ transplant recipients.
So first, I saw that you lead a research program on qualifying the risk of second cancers among cancer survivors. Could you tell me a bit about the scope and goals of that program and why it was started?
Absolutely. So I think this is an incredibly exciting time for cancer patients because it feels like the pace of scientific discovery and then the translation of those discoveries into the clinic has really accelerated in recent years. There are many more types of treatments that have been introduced and shown to be really effective in treating a number of different types of cancer. And so that means patients can live longer and hopefully healthier lives. Of course, when treatments are introduced, it can be recognized that there's the substantial benefit in treating the cancer, but there may also be some adverse effects. Those can be happening when a patient is going through treatment, or it can occur, in the months or years immediately after treatment. And actually, what we also know is that unfortunately, some of those adverse effects don't develop for a much longer time. So part of my research program is to study the long-term adverse effects of treatment. And the goal is to provide patients and clinicians with information about risks and benefits. And then there's another component also, which is that quantifying the adverse effects of treatment really helps drive the development of new treatments that might have fewer adverse effects. So maybe it drives development of new treatments, or perhaps actually just drive the development of different treatment approaches. So maybe it's a slightly different combination of chemotherapy drugs, or maybe it's a different dose of radiation. Or actually, one of the other changes that has been made was to discover that the it's called the treatment field, the radiation field, so the portions of the body that are treated with radiotherapy, that for certain patients, you can actually treat a much smaller region with radiotherapy than patients were treated with in the past. And that means, for example, when you're looking at the adverse effects of radiation exposure, then a much smaller portion of the body would be at risk of developing those adverse effects. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sense of, the scope, the goals, and the context. The other comment that I wanted to make was that the earliest work in the adverse effects of therapy started not long after patients were first started to be treated with combination chemotherapy or chemotherapy and radiotherapy. But there's really been this tremendous expansion in the field in more recent years. And one of the questions that we're asking ourselves is what we can do to try and predict the risks that a patient might face 5, 10, 20, or 30 years after their treatment without having to wait that much time for that much time to pass. So can we use information from other patients or patients treated historically or treated for other diseases or other kind of theoretical models and predict for patients what those long-term adverse effects would look like? That's a less developed part of our field, but I hope really reflects the idea that the goal is to help patients live longer and healthier lives and to try and push the science to advance as quickly as possible in order to help patients in that way.
I see. Definitely a great breakdown. Thank you. And I know you talked a little bit about, you know, some of the adverse effects and maybe the risks. Going into it a little bit deeper, what risk factors make lymphoma and other cancer survivors susceptible to developing a second cancer?
I often think about risk factors for second cancers in three different categories. One, and the one that we know the most about, is the treatment exposures. Whether that's systemic therapy or radiotherapy. There's another which we're just starting to make inroads into, and that is genetic susceptibility. So we do have evidence in a number of other settings that some people are more genetically susceptible to developing cancer. We also have more theoretical knowledge than strong observational data, but we're building the observational data that some patients might be more susceptible to having adverse effects after an exposure to something. So not necessarily a cancer treatment, but say, are there some individuals who are genetically susceptible to damage from lung cancer, from smoking? That could then lead to cancer or heart disease. And the reason that I think that genetic susceptibility is very important is because it would help us to tailor the risk and benefit assessment in the clinic to specific patients. And the third category, when I think about risk factors for developing a second cancer, is lifestyle factors. There's a lot of research that is ongoing and has recently been published that's trying to understand what patients might be able to do to modify their own lifestyle factors that could impact their long-term health. So we know pretty much every study shows that quitting smoking, if you're a smoker, improves your long-term health. But what about dietary interventions or exercise interventions? Are any of those really meaningfully playing a role in impacting second cancer risk? And I don't think that we have those answers all squared away yet, but there's a lot of attention to the idea that many times patients are very motivated after they've gone through treatment and they're in remission from their cancer to say, what can I do? Because I want to live a long and healthy life. And I think as scientists, what we need to do is empower patients with that information about what they can actually do that will make a meaningful difference.
I know you went into a little bit about genetics as a risk for that. I also saw that you completed an international study of second primary gastrointestinal cancers among survivors of Hodgkin lymphoma and breast, cervical, and testicular cancer, and so forth. What were some of your findings from that research?
Yeah, so that study was a really important study for a number of different reasons. And again, when we go back to when we're talking about the treatment, kind of separating a little bit the radiotherapy from the chemotherapy exposures. So we know that ionizing radiation causes cancer in a number of different tissues. But we actually didn't know a lot about the risk of gastrointestinal cancers at the time that the study was initiated. We had some evidence from some other populations exposed to radiation, including even the atomic bomb survivors, that there was increased risk of gastrointestinal cancers. But that's a very different type of exposure than a patient who's receiving radiotherapy to treat their cancer. The dose was very different. The duration of that dose was very different. And those things are important for understanding cancer risk after radiation exposure. So in this international study, we were able to demonstrate that radiotherapy increases the risk for gastric cancer, pancreatic cancer, and esophageal cancer. It's really important to keep in mind that these are very rare cancers. When it comes to, for example, clinical intervention or anything like that, that there was not necessarily a direct finding to translate into the clinic. But it's very important for patients and their providers to be aware that this may be an issue. So the example that we often thought about was that, of course, in this study, we couldn't comprehensively evaluate, you know, screening or anything like that. but perhaps a patient who has a history of abdominal radiotherapy, if they're having GI symptoms, they should pay attention to those and talk with their doctor about the fact that they've had abdominal radiotherapy in the past. The other reason that this study was really important was that, you know, I've talked about the history of studying adverse effects of treatment. Some of the earliest observations were that there were certain types of chemotherapy that caused treatment-related leukemia. We've known that for decades. I think the first studies came out in the late 60s and 1960s and early 1970s. And there's still more to be learned about treatment-related leukemia. But as time went on, scientists increasingly were making the observation that while the occurrence was very rare, chemotherapy might also increase the risk of developing other cancers, not just leukemia. And so we had comprehensive data for all of the patients, whether they had Hodgkin lymphoma, breast cancer, cervical cancer, testicular cancer, not just on their radiotherapy, but also on their chemotherapy exposures. And we were able to demonstrate that there was increased risk, particularly for stomach cancer and pancreatic cancer, associated with certain chemotherapies. So not all types of chemotherapy, just certain drugs. But it was very important to change the way that scientists were thinking about how to study the adverse effects of chemotherapy, to understand that we needed to take an even broader look at health outcomes among patients.
I also saw that you are leading studies in identifying second cancer risks in high-risk populations, mm-hmm. such as recipients of solid organ and stem cell transplants. Can you tell me a little bit more about this research?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we think about the risk of cancer in patients who've received a solid organ transplant, what we're learning a lot about is the risk of cancer associated with immunosuppression. This can be particularly important when we're talking about survivors of hematologic malignancies, so cancers of the immune system. And we want to make sure that we can understand what is the long-term health of their immune system after having recovered from their cancer. The stem cell transplant studies, I think, are even more directly related to patients with hematologic malignancies because stem cell transplants often can be part of the therapeutic approach to treating the cancer. And in order to induce immunosuppression in patients so that they can receive a solid organ, actually, or a stem cell transplant, you have to suppress a patient's immune system because otherwise their own immune system will attack the transplant. And of course, then the transplant will not work. And so the question is, what is the role of the different treatment approaches that are used to suppress their immune system before the transplant? And then also perhaps long-term immunosuppression. And you know, what are the roles of those medical exposures in their second cancer risks?
We've covered a lot of ground, like covering a lot of different cancer types and adverse effects associated with different treatment styles, such as radiation and stem cell transplants. It's a lot to take in, but mm-hmm. taking all this into consideration, how might these studies inform clinical strategies for preventing the risk of second cancers?
Absolutely. So the way that I often like to think about it is that we need to break down this very complicated process into different steps. And so the first step, of course, is a patient having an accurate diagnosis and then getting the optimal therapy to treat their cancer. And that's not obviously my primary research program, but then it's almost, you can think of it a little bit like a relay. And then, so there are people who've run that relay even before that happens, who have learned about the diagnosis and who have developed those optimal treatment strategies. They then hand the baton to the doctor who's actually treating the patient. And then that baton can come to someone like me, where my goal is to first try and quantify what are the health risks that patients might face. And then I might hand that baton on to another scientist or clinician who's going to better understand. Now that we know what those risks are, we know how big they are, we know how common they are, then that individual can develop a strategy to actually prevent second cancers. There's another kind of that's a little bit of a linear process. There's almost an orthogonal approach also, which I alluded to earlier, which is when we can quantify the risks of adverse effects, that information, I think, feeds back into this process of trying to help patients live long and healthy lives, which is that when we see that there are adverse effects that patients are facing, the basic scientists are motivated to then go back and develop new treatments that don't have those same adverse effects. And there are ways that certain medicines can be tweaked in a particular way or combined with another type of medicine that would reduce those adverse effects. What I try and do is provide that quantitative information. So as I said, we know how big the risks are and we know how common they are. The only other thing I'll just make explicit in that process is that the strategies that you can take, the clinical strategies for preventing a second cancer, really are impacted by those two parameters that I'm talking about. So if the risk is very high and it's very common, that would argue for a much more aggressive intervention in a broad patient population. If the risks are very low and they're very rare, you wouldn't want to intervene, right? Because it would be very unlikely to occur. What if they're somewhere in between that? Either the risks are high, but it's rare. So it would only affect a small number of patients, but it would really substantially impact them. Or the risks might be a little bit more modest, but it could impact a lot of people. Then different strategies can be taken to kind of on the whole, inform clinical care for patients. So that's one of the reasons why I am excited about my leg of the relay, as it were, is that I feel like I can hopefully provide really valuable information to try and design those strategies.
Very detailed breakdown. Thank you. I did like how you put it, likening it to a relay race and trying to prevent these second cancers. But considering that we are in the middle of National Cancer Survivors Month, what do you hope your colleagues sort of take away from this conversation?
So I think I'll stay with that relay analogy. I really hope that both colleagues and patients think about taking care of a patient as a relay that involves many people. And every leg of that relay is very important, from the patients themselves, to the individuals who are supporting those patients, to the doctors who are diagnosing them and treating them and then taking care of them long term, and the scientists who are trying to improve kind of at every step of the way. I hope that this conversation provides hope to both colleagues and patients, and also really emphasizes the importance. It's amazing to see the advances that have been made in treating many different cancers. There are other cancers where those advances haven't been made, and there's need for more work in those areas, of course, as well. But for those patients where, you know, the treatments have improved and survival is very long, then we need everybody to be participating in the relay, as I said, to just help those patients live long and healthy lives.
Great. Thank you. Those were all the questions that I had for you. Was there anything else that you wanted to say on this matter or on anything else?
No, I appreciate the chance to share some information.
Thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us at Twitter @cancernetwork without the O. We're on Facebook and LinkedIn @cancer-network.